Were you expecting lecture notes? I didn't realize this.
Sorry?
Were you guys told there would be lecture notes?
Because Giuseppe had lecture notes. He uploaded them.
Oh, yeah. Giuseppe works very hard. I'm a... You get table service in the lecture? It's like.
I thought it would be funny if you delivered some oat milk hot chocolate with some oat milk golden milk.
So we were discussing how to go from Lagrangian. New Hamiltonian mechanics. So I explained how we do this, and we got a little bit hung up on the variational one form. But after some kind of collaborative discussions, I think we came up with a clean picture, which is, let me write it out. So the symplectic manifold M is equal to the set of solutions to the Euler-Lagrange equations. Now, if phi is my field, let's consider my action on an interval. Now, what we realized from our question yesterday is, well, the variation of this, that is its derivative, I'll write it as delta, which is traditional, this vanishes for variations which are 0 near the boundary. So this means it's the difference of two boundary terms. And we defined the variational one form to be the boundary term coming from 0. Okay, so this is just a review of how we did this last time. This perspective, you see a little more than we did last time, which is, for instance, when I write curly delta, this is the traditional notation for the exterior derivative on some space of fields. So it's really the same as d. So this notation tells us that d squared of s, 0, 1, which is equal to 0, is d alpha 0 minus d alpha 1. So d alpha 0 equal to d alpha 1, and we get the same symplectic form. This chalk is getting very faint.
Why delta S is defined as the one forms at the endpoints? I mean,
well,
is this endpoints or is this just two points on the manifold? What is happening here?
So my time, 0, 1 refers to time. Time runs from 0 to 1.
Okay.
And if I vary my field in the middle, because it satisfies the equations of motion, nothing happens. S doesn't change. Because the definition of the Euler Lagrange equations is that when you vary it away from the boundary, nothing happens.
But why is it changing at the endpoints?
Well, it could. And if you compute it in examples, it does.
Mm-hmm.
Like last time we computed it for the Lagrangian phi dt squared phi. And if you vary phi a little bit, you found that there was a boundary term involving the first derivative, and that. Okay, so today I want to do two things. First thing to do is do a field theory example. And the second thing is explain how to go backwards. The Hamiltonian to the Lagrangian picture.
Would you mind saying one more time why we set equal to alpha naught?
I have to say, I still find this a little mysterious. We somehow want to start with our Lagrangian and build a symplectic manifold. And this procedure does the right thing. Perhaps things will be clarified when we go backwards. Because when we go backwards, we're going to build a Lagrangian, and the ingredients in it will be the variational one form and the Hamiltonian. And that Lagrangian will be equivalent to the one we started.
Okay.
That might clarify things.
Okay.
In my head, I think of alpha zero as like the piece of the action coming from zero.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, you might want to think the whole action comes from integrating that.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. Okay, so what's the field theory example?
Sorry, I should probably know this, but what do you mean when you say we get the same symplectic form from zero or one because d alpha zero is d alpha one? Why is that significant? I mean.
Sorry, I should have clarified. We define the symplectic form to be omega is d alpha. That's how we define the symplectic form. This is a two form, a one form. You see, we wanted to get a two form. So this is the thing that in local coordinates is dp dq.
Why is that symplectic?
Well, what does it mean to be symplectic? It means it needs to be a two form, which it certainly is. It's closed, which it certainly is, because d of it is d squared alpha. And there's another condition, which Giuseppe, I think, explained, which is that in local coordinates, it needs to look like dp dq.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a non-degeneracy condition. Now, that condition is not obvious. If you started with a Lagrangian 0, that would not be satisfied. So the final condition on being symplectic, that it's non-degenerate, is related to the statement that the Lagrangian you started with was a good, sensible Lagrangian and not something stupid.
So first you have to construct a Lagrangian to see that this determinant doesn't go to zero? The determinant of components, if you write it in components, I mean.
Well, the way it works, I think we saw last time, is if you start with the Lagrangian and you compute what omega is,
mm-hmm.
omega is built from the kinetic term of the Lagrangian. Now, the non-degeneracy of omega is going to be related to the fact that the Lagrangian is a non-degenerate kinetic term. So if I wrote my Lagrangian, which was just I cubed with no kinetic term, that doesn't make any sense. That's really bad. You can't do field theory with that. And that would not give you a symplectic manifold either. So let's discuss. A field theory example. You can take M to be a Riemannian as Euclidean signature. Or it's going to take a space-time which is M times OR. Where OR is time. And we're going to take a field, which is a scalar field on this manifold, with the action phi bot phi. So for example, if M is the circle, then this action would look like integral M cross OR of I times del T squared minus del theta squared. And more generally, it looks like where the Laplacian on M has a positive spectrum. I'm just trying to get the signs right. You notice that del theta squared has negative spectrum because if I differentiate cos twice, I get minus cos. So minus del theta squared has positive spectrum, which is the condition. So how did we go about constructing the phase space? Well, the first thing we did was look at the solutions to the equations of motion.
Define time to be the reals cross the manifold? How come it wouldn't be just another dimension in the manifold?
You were right that, you know, I'm kind of breaking Lorentz invariance by writing it this way. It's just convenient to separate things into space and time.
Okay.
I'm choosing a time coordinate. The whole thing will be Lorentz invariant. If M was or N, everything would be invariant under the Lorentz symmetry group. But in the presentation, I'm breaking that. So what's this equation? Let's expand phi as phi naught plus t phi 1 t squared phi 2. And this equation if you look at it up there, it will tell you that twice phi 2 plus Laplacian phi 0 equals 0. So that everything is determined by the first two terms. Is this illegible? This chalk seems to be terrible.
Yes, I can't read it.
You can't read it? What's going on here?
If you wrote, if you, instead of m cross r, if you wrote the pure time as also a part of the manifold,
yes,
then when you wanted to define a phase space on the cotangent bundle, how would you add the t to your, because you extended your r n dimensional chart to r to n, but if there was a t, there is no momentum that would eat the vector that defines the flow of t and gives you a number. Is it a 2n plus 1 dimensional?
The phase space is going to be infinite dimension because to define a point in the phase space, I need to specify phi 0 and phi 1, and they can depend in any way you like on the internal manifold M. So the phase space looks like a space of functions on M. So classical field theory has an infinite number of degrees of freedom. Does that answer your question?
I might want to think about it and rephrase my question.
Okay.
Sorry, I've got another question.
Yeah.
You wrote where delta M has the spectrum. What do you mean by that?
The spectrum is the set of eigenvalues. Mm. So let's look in the case of the circle. Mm-hmm. The d by d theta squared, the eigenvalues are cos of n theta and sine of n theta. Mm-hmm. And the eigenvectors, the eigenvalues are all n squared. Mm-hmm. So that's in the case of the circle, the way I've chosen it with that minus sign is it ensures all those eigenvalues are positive. So on a more complicated manifold, it's really hard to write down explicitly what the eigenvalues are. But I just want to choose my convention so that they're positive numbers. So probably thinking about the case of the circle, you won't want to lose any generality.
That means positive.
Yes, sorry, yes.
Okay, thank you.
My strange conventions. So when we look at the phase space, it's the space of solutions to the equations in motion. And everything is determined by the first two terms. So we let u of x be the value of phi, that's phi, the point x, 0, where x is in my manifold. And e of x the other term okay now last time we played this game where we said let's calculate the variational one form by looking at the action and seeing that if the equations of motion are satisfied, it's a total derivative and so on. We that game can be repeated in this context. Nothing really changes. I won't give all the details. So the variational one form, alpha, is the integral over x in the manifold of of x dp of x. And to calculate the Hamiltonian, let's look at the equations of motion, which we've written down here in series, and think about how that tells us what the time derivatives are. The Hamiltonian, if we notice that, E of x is the time derivative u of x, whereas the Laplacian is minus the time derivative u of x. So this is just a consequence of the definition. P is defined to be the derivative of Q. And if we look at this equation, well, there's a factor of 2 missing. Actually, no, there isn't. When I differentiate this, like this is related to the passing of this, and it's also related to the derivative of that. So we conclude in this way. Let me write this out more clearly. Yes?
I think you mentioned it in the last lecture, but would you mind reminding me why P ends up being equal to phi 1 of x?
Well, these are just convenient coordinates. So the phase space is the collection of solutions to the equations of motion. And to give a solution, I need to tell you the initial value and its first derivative. I'm going to call the initial value q, and I'll just call the first derivative p. So these are nice coordinates.
Okay.
And then we do a little manipulation of playing around with the Lagrangian, and that tells us this is the variational one.
Would it be right to say that the higher terms would be like if we have position, momentum, then maybe we'd have acceleration, and then.
But they're.
Terms or no?
They're not independent though.
Okay.
Because phi satisfies the differential equation, the second derivative of phi. Where did I write it down? Right over here.
Box of phi is zero?
Yeah, so like the second derivative of phi plus the Laplacian of phi equal to zero. So like the acceleration is expressed in terms of a just spatial derivative. So that's nothing new. Acceleration is already there. Mm-hmm. So that's this equation here, right? That the first derivative of p, which is the second derivative of q, is something in terms of q.
So is it because we have, like, here it's like second derivative, so we have to have a, like, the phi naught and the phi one, because, you know, then we can define it because it jumps to every
single. Exactly, that's exactly it, yes. The second derivative tells you phi two is determined by phi zero, phi three by phi one, phi four by phi two by phi zero, and so on.
Yeah. These things that we did, we had a equation of motion that we need two initial values, but we don't have any boundary, because in the example that you did, the space doesn't have boundary. But what happens if instead of writing S1, you write a manifold with boundary?
Oh yeah, that's a really good question. So what do you have to do is, yeah, if instead of the circle there was a manifold with boundary, what you would have to do there is choose a nice boundary condition for your fields on the boundary of that manifold. For example, in the case of a scalar field, at the boundary of space, we would have to choose Neumann or Dirichlet boundary conditions. And if we did that, then everything would work the same.
And would you add the boundary conditions here, or is it equivalent to other boundary term?
I wouldn't think of it as adding a boundary term. I would think of, like, suppose it was Dirichlet, so that phi was 0 on the boundary. I would say, well, in each of these terms, phi is 0 on the boundary.
Sorry, I have so many questions. Looking at the definition from last time, or the derivation, how come this time we don't include the anti-symmetric part, or like the PDQ, the minus the PDQ?
Oh, yeah, I probably just made a mistake.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't really matter because they differ by total derivatives. How are you going to do it?
Okay.
So is it like half minus PDQ? Is that the correct expression?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Doesn't really make a difference.
I think the one form is just QDP, and then we take the exterior derivative to get the
PQDP. Okay. Yeah, it's all. Okay, so now we know what the phase space is. Let's figure out the Hamiltonian. So we have these equations, which are the same ones we had before. But except whereas before we had some kind of number here, now we have the Laplacian operator. But things are going to work the same. These tell us the Hamiltonian is the integral over the manifold of half P of x squared plus Q of x Laplacian Q of x. So how do we interpret this? At each x in M, we have or 2 as a symplectic manifold. So it looks like at each point in my manifold, I just have an ordinary particle, an ordinary kind of classical mechanical particle. The Hamiltonian, the potential in the Hamiltonian, links nearby points. As it has the Laplacian, which is some derivative. So, now in my head, how am I thinking about this? I didn't have this term here. I would say at each point in my manifold, I just have a free particle. And this term here is a little bit like a harmonic oscillator term. So it's a little bit like at each point in my manifold, I had a spring moving back and forth, except the potential energy is not determined by just what happens at this point. It's determined by the interaction between one point and its neighbors. So it's like the kind of standard thing to imagine is a bunch of springs on my manifold, and they're all kind of linked to each other. So if I extend one, I get some potential energy determined by the distance to the nearby points. Okay, let's now discuss what happens in the case of the circle and how we can use Fourier analysis to simplify this into a system of honest harmonic oscillators. Suppose M is equal to S1. And then in that case, I'll write P of theta, and I can expand them to Fourier mode. So the symplectic form, or the variational one form, is integral p of x dq of x dp. Now, if I insert this Fourier expansion in, the integral will be zero, except for when I integrate Pn against Qn plus, or Pn minus against Qn minus, just by the orthogonality relation. So, this is good. It looks like we've taken our system and replaced it by a bunch of free particles, one for every Fourier mode. The next thing to do is we'll really have to figure out the Hamiltonian to figure out if these systems interact with each other or not. Well, Hamiltonian, yeah.
What? That if the p dq doesn't make any difference in the integral, and because now you also ignored it?
It's because the only thing that matters in the end is the symplectic form, d alpha.
Okay.
And that.
So the constants times the wedge of dq dp doesn't matter?
Well, because dp dq. Like minus dp dq is the same as dq dp,
yeah.
So they add up to, they cancel out that factor.
And what did you do in the integral when you wrote it in terms of theta? Because you added theta in some.
Well, that was implicitly there all the time. This is an integral over the manifold, so I had to integrate against the volume element of my manifold. I'm just averaging over this manifold. So the subtlety is that this d is not derivative on this manifold, it's derivative on the phase. So I can be confusing notation. Yeah.
I might be wrong about this, but shouldn't it be, I thought it would be plus minus, because, so if we have it as plus or minus minus, it would be cosine times sine, which is an even, an odd function. So the integral should.
Oh, no, I wanted it to be.
Should it be g's maybe?
Plus plus because it's cos squared. Minus minus is sine squared.
But we have the d of p.
What's that?
We have d of p.
Okay, but d is not derivative on here. It's derivative on the phase space. So it's like that, right? So at each point in my manifold, the phase space is something which takes a point in the circle and sends it to R2. The phase space is the space of maps from the circle to R2. I want to write down a one form in the phase space, so I'm differentiating on that space of maps. I'm not differentiating on the circle. So it's just like when you're doing a functional derivative, you're differentiating the Lagrangian with respect to varying the field. you're not differentiating on space-time, exactly like that. So, which is why sometimes people use the curly delta notation because it's less confusing. But I've been going back and forth for extra confusion. Where were we? And then, well, the Hamiltonian is, yeah, the Laplacian is minus d theta squared. So the Laplacian on cos n theta, or sine n theta, is n squared cos n theta. So the Hamiltonian is sum, you write it out, it's the integral.
Sorry, was it QDP or PDQ? Because it looks.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Thank you. Theta squared plus U theta minus. So I'm probably gonna be dropping a factor of two here or something, but so I get Pn plus squared plus Pn minus squared plus n squared un plus squared plus n squared un minus. So what have we found? This is literally a collection of harmonic oscillators. So un plus minus un plus minus is a harmonic oscillator. With n of energy n squared. So I hope this kind of thing, have you guys seen this kind of thing before?
What specifically?
Taking a quantum field theory and looking at its modes on a circle and finding raising and lowering operators, for instance.
Done modal expansions with raising and lowering operators, but I don't think we've ever talked about them on a circle.
Okay. Well, when we quantize the system, these E's and Q's will become just a collection of raising and lowering operators for states of this two-dimensional free field theory. We're not there.
That R2 is the symplectic manifold in this case because we are working with scalar fields.
Yes.
If we have n components of field, it will be R2 n.
Yes, exactly. Is there a question at the back?
Can you explain again how the integral went away and became. Okay, I guess the sum is over there. How did the integral disappear?
This integral here?
Yeah.
Well, I've just
I've
just inserted the Fourier expansion and then used the fact that the Fourier modes are orthogonal. So, the integral of I'll get the integral of cos n times sine or cos times cos, whatever, they all drop out except cos n times cos n, sine n times sine.
I just want to ask, so I'm a little lost on the big picture. What role does you know, this Hamiltonian with raising and lowering operators in a circle play with the big play in the big picture.
Okay, so you might ask again, what are we trying to do? So we start off, if we have a classical particle, we know how to describe it in terms of a Lagrangian, and we know how to describe it in terms of a symplectic manifold of the Hamiltonian. The picture with the symplectic manifold and the Hamiltonian is a really good one, because the Hamiltonian tells you the total energy of the system. And when we want to quantize, we could learn about the spectrum of excitations of the quantum system by thinking about the Hamiltonian. Now, here we're starting with the two-dimensional free field, and we want to figure out the Hamiltonian because that's going to tell us about the energy of the system. And we're calculating Hamiltonian of a two-dimensional free field by using the same method we did for just a particle. We solve the equations of motion to find the phase space. Here the phase space is really big. It's a space of functions, and it's convenient to express the phase space in terms of the Fourier modes of P and Q. And then we just calculated the Hamiltonian, and now we kind of understand exactly what the system is. It's just a system of harmonic oscillators.
Do we also have the non-computation relations that we have in quantum mechanics between P plus minus and Q plus minus here?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I was going to come to that later, but on any symplectic manifold, if I have dpi wedge dqi, this means I'm going to get canonical commutation relations, pi qj h bar delta. So the symplectic form is kind of a classical limit of the canonical commutation relations.
I don't exactly see how it pops out suddenly, because like we're starting from some symplectic form, which is completely classical, and we're not quantizing anything.
No, you're absolutely right. Though, if I wanted to derive this, and I wanted to do that later, I would say, from the Lagrangian point of view, I kind of know what to do. I do the path integral. Then from the path integral, and because we know how to relate the Lagrangian with the Hamiltonian perspectives, that tells us what to do in the Hamiltonian perspective too. So for me, that's the best derivation.
So we're going to see.
Yeah. Okay. The next thing I want to discuss is going from the Hamiltonian to the Lagrangian. And I want to do it in such a way that if I went Lagrangian to Hamiltonian back, we got back the Lagrangian we started. So let's do it in an example. Well, let me do it in general first. M is my symplectic manifold. And I'm going to assume for now, this assumption can be relaxed later, that the symplectic form is E of alpha, so that it's an exact two form. And H is the Hamiltonian. So I want to build a Lagrangian. The Lagrangian is going to be built from a field, depending only on time. And my field is going to live in this manifold. So So gamma is a path moving around the phase space. Is it a question?
I have a question maybe related to the previous part here. Did you mention something about this definition of omega only works if the phase space has a trivial topology? Or
did you say that again, sorry?
Did you mention something about like the definition of two synthetic two-form only works if the phase space has a specific trivial topology? Or
like this equation can only hold. There's going to be a topological obstruction to this equation holding.
Yeah, can we always define? Can we always define this
equation? We can't. No. So I want to. This assumption is going to be relaxed later. But if my symplectic manifold was a torus, a two torus, then this would not hold.
So there when we found the alpha, is it because our phase space is connected set?
Well, basically, what you're going to find is if you start with an ordinary Lagrangian with nothing weird in it, and you know, maybe ordinary gauge symmetry, then you'll always end up with a phase space like this. But there are some kind of weird Lagrangians in the literature. Chern-Simons are the Wiesemino model, which have some kind of slightly weird terms. And those weird terms will appear when you will be related to phase spaces with more interesting topology. So your plain vanilla Lagrangians you'll find in Peskin and Schroeder will always look like this. So for now, we'll make this assumption, and I'll explain later how we can relax. Okay, so how do we get back my Lagrangian? I want to consider a field which is a particle moving around this manifold. And the action for gamma is integral over R of the pullback of the symplectic form plus Hamiltonian times dt. I mean, not the pullback of the symplectic form, the pullback of this one. So this is, you know, these are the things I have in my symplectic manifold, a one form and a function. This is really the only possible thing you could do. So it's extremely simple. Gamma star alpha. Because if I want to integrate over the real line, I need a one form.
Well, field is defined as a map from space time manifold to.
Yes. And here
this is for S1.
No, this is a one dimensional field, the particle. I only have time and I have no space.
And it maps to the configuration space of the fields, but not.
No, it maps to the phase space.
It maps to the phase space?
Yes.
I have the same question, actually, as that. And the symplectic manifold, how is it the same thing as the phase space of the system?
How is it the same thing?
How is it the same thing as the phase space of the system?
Well, if I started with the Lagrangian, then the symplectic manifold you build is the phase space. You define the symplectic manifold to be the phase space.
But when we define the curve gamma from R to M,
yeah,
aren't we already specifying some sort of dynamics? Because the curve on M is something dynamical about.
Yes, we are. There's dynamics both of the term involving H. Tells us the dynamics. I mean, I think it'll be clearer if I work out it. I do an example and see how it reverses the procedure from last time. suppose we start with Lagrangian. So this is a very simple Lagrangian we considered last time. How do we get the phase space? We found this last time is R2 with coordinates P and Q, where the variational one form is PDP. And I'm going to allow myself to integrate by parts the variational one form and maybe change it into minus PDQ if I want to. Yeah.
Sorry, back to that. I think you said something about you could prove that it the action has to be like this. I really don't understand. I don't quite understand why.
Oh, I wouldn't say you could prove that. It's just, you know.
Is it because you defined alpha to be like delta S and then... if you take the integral of that, that would give you the endpoints, and then edge.
Yeah. Exactly. That's
h bar. Why do you have to put?
That's the dynamics of your path, and then the gamma star alpha gives you the pullback of your manifold, which is the endpoints.
Why do you add them?
Because the endpoints plus the path is the action.
Oh.
Yeah, I think you said something really nice. That like, why do you get the first term? Alpha was, you started with some action, and alpha was kind of the contribution of that action from zero. Now we're integrating that. That's going to recover the action. Because we have to add on the second term. But I think this going through it in this example will clarify. So we found last time, alpha is QDP, and the Hamiltonian is half E squared. Plus Q squared. So now, if we want to go backwards, we let P and Q depend on time. So I make them into P of T. M of t is this vector. So what's my action? I is integral u of t e of t plus half.
Sorry, now I'm kind of confused. Why is the action comprised of the action of endpoints plus the path? I mean, because I would assume the action would be just the integral of the Hamiltonian.
Mm-hmm.
Or I mean, either is the first term or the second term. What is it? First term plus the second term.
Let's finish this example. I think you'll see. I mean, the reason is going to be, if I just use the Hamiltonian, there's nothing there that tells me P needs to be the derivative of Q. This term tells me that. Actually, let me rewrite the action slightly by integration by parts. This is a slightly better way. Minus integral
should be just the integral of alpha. That's it.
All right, I know you're reaching for like a fully general understanding of why this works. I feel I'm not sure I have a super clear way of saying it. So let's take this action. We write it like this way. And then we notice something somebody mentioned the other day. E is an auxiliary field. E satisfies an algebraic equation of motion. There's no derivatives of P inside at all. So there's this procedure, or you can integrate out P.
So many questions.
I want to integrate out a field, but classically, to integrate out an auxiliary field like this, you just solve the equations of motion and reinsert those back in. P satisfies algebraic equations of motion that I get from varying P. P equals.
Are you allowed to do all of these manipulations? Because at the end of the day, you need DS. You don't care about S itself.
You mean the manipulations where I, like this, this particular one?
QDP, you say PDQ, and because also alpha wasn't QDP, it was 1 half QDP minus PDQ.
Oh, yeah, you're worried about boundary terms in the action?
Yeah.
The boundary terms in the action basically never play a role.
What, why?
Well, it might depend on what you're computing. If I'm computing in some quantum system, how operator product expansions or something like this, correlation functions, what happens at infinity doesn't really matter.
Are you going to always work with ds, d of s, or delta s?
No, but I'm going to work with the Lagrangian up to total derivatives.
Oh.
I mean, to be honest, we are working classically, so classically, you just see the equations of motion is encoded by ds, so that's a fair point. But even quantum mechanically, the Lagrangian of the total derivatives is what's going to be relevant. Okay. So we have P, satisfies this algebraic equation of motion. So we can get rid of P and insert it back in the action. So S is equivalent. The action with only U. Minus integral L P Q squared plus a half T squared, half del T Q squared. And this expression is what we started with. Add these terms together. And then I integrate this term by parts. Wrong.
So is the negative just in front of the first term?
Yes, just in front of the first term.
No, I mean on the line above, the negative that's outside.
Oh, yeah. You're right. It is.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Now, what have we seen? We've gone through this example, and we started with the standard Lagrangian, built the phase space, and then tried to go backwards by saying, well, what if you have a particle moving in the phase space? And if we do that, we found our Lagrangian again. But the first way it appeared was in this first order formulation with an auxiliary field called E.
Can you, I mean, yes, it, for this example, it works, but can you explain why we need the both terms there?
Mm-hmm.
Store alpha plus HTT.
Well, I think they convinced the, you want to say that if we apply our procedure from before to this, like what's the phase space of this Lagrangian? We'll get back our original phase space. What's the Hamiltonian? We'll get back our original Hamiltonian. That's the exercise you need to do. That make sense?
Can you explain further what should I do to recover my Hamiltonian and the Lagrangian?
Okay. Doing something? There was another question there.
I think that's
let me kind of write out the diagram again and I'll check. And we've really got everything. Lagrangian. What we've seen so far is we start with a Lagrangian, we build a phase space, and we can build a Lagrangian again. That's actually the same one we started with, now in the first order formulation. So the thing the question was about is like if we start with the Hamiltonian setting, and we write down that Lagrangian, and then go back and build a phase space, will we get what we started? If we have M and omega, which is d alpha, and h, we can build a Lagrangian. Where gamma and we need to check is the phase space. Is the phase space going to be equal to M? And do we also get the correct one form and the correct Hamiltonian? Now let's try and check this in coordinates. Then in these coordinates, having this path moving in the manifold just means that Q and P depend on time. And let's write out the action. I'll leave this up there. So the action looks like this. Qi of t PRP plus H QT. And the key point is that the Hamiltonian has no derivatives. So firstly, sir, we want to say that this action really does have the phase space and the dynamics given by E's and Q's with this Hamiltonian. So we do this by solving the equations of motion. So the phase space is the solutions to the equations of motion. The equations of motion are M, if we vary Q, so this is just by varying P and Q. So what does this tell us? It tells us that the derivatives, the first derivatives of P and Q, they're nothing new. They're the expressions in P and Q. So the phase space is parameterized just by P and Q, and their derivatives are not independent. Well, that's good. That's what we wanted. The phase space is the manifold with coordinates P and Q again. Good. And so this equation also tells us how P and Q evolve with time.
Sorry, how do you derive these equations of motion right now? What are we allowed to do? Because
I'm just varying Q, and I'm never ever keeping boundary terms. Boundary terms don't appear in equations of motion. So I'm just, you know, I vary Q. Or this is some kind of polynomial in P's and Q's. There's no derivatives. Mm-hmm. So when I vary variation of Q with this is just differentiate.
Mm-hmm.
So d by dt of P plus the Q derivative of this is zero. That's this equation. And for this one, I've integrated by parts to bring that over here, and then vary P, and I get the same equation with a different sign. Yep.
I assume that my Hamiltonian initially comes from a 3 plus 1 new compositional space-time, and then I want to go back to the Lagrangian. How do I make sure it does not depend on the type of relation that I've done? And would I be able to recover the Lagrangian only up to constraints?
So constraints is a separate issue. So we haven't discussed the constraints you need to impose when you have a gauge theory. I wanted to come to that soon, so let's put that aside. So suppose you had a 3 plus 1 dimensional Lagrangian just with scalars. Okay? I think what will happen is that when you do this procedure and put it in this first order formulation, it will have a first derivative in time, but it will still have a second derivative in space. So this expression up here will not be obviously Lorentz invariant. It will be Lorentz invariant because it does go back to the original Lagrangian when I've integrated out an auxiliary. Clarify, does that answer your question? Okay, so. We've.
is like adding another genre.
Well, I think we can kind of see why we need these two terms, right? This term tells us that the first derivatives are not independent. Therefore, we have the correct phase space. This term tells us how P and Q evolve with time, and therefore tells us Hamiltonian.
Going back to that equation, I want to understand intuitively what it means. In the right-hand side of the integral, we have to have a Lagrangian. And since you wrote the Hamiltonian, the gamma star alpha, the pullback on alpha has to be like a Legendre transformation.
I think the Legendre transformation...
Because you're
I think that it will come in when I do...
To a Lagrangian in a way, I think.
In the coordinates, it is like P, Q dot, DT. That's what the pullback will be in those coordinates.
Yeah.
Well, that was because it was P, DQ. Ah, yeah, it all makes sense.
That makes sense?
Yeah. Yeah, it all makes sense.
You seem to like it, yes. I never really learned very much about the Legendre transformation. Well, you guys are doing that in homework. I think we kind of see that the time derivative of P we can check. I won't do that now. That omega is dpi. Ui. So if we know this, we see that the time derivative of p is equal to the Poisson bracket of Hamiltonian. Because the Poisson bracket with p is a q derivative. Also equal to the Poisson bracket. So that H really is the Hamiltonian. Yep. If I start with a symplectic manifold with a function, like the flow generated by the function is defined by this equation. This is a characterizing property of the Hamiltonian, that the time derivative of anything is Poisson bracket. So are you guys convinced by how we go back and forth between Lagrangian and Hamiltonian pictures? So maybe for the last...
I guess I'm a bit confused about, so to the order, I think up to linear and T of the fields, everything works out. We have the Hamiltonian and everything.
Mm-hmm.
How do we build it? Like, how do we show that the phase space we obtain from the fields is actually the same manifold as this?
Well, the phase space is defined to be the space of solutions to the equations of motion. So if we started with this Lagrangian, the equations of motion expresses the first derivative in terms of the zeroth derivatives. So it means that we can parameterize the equations of motion, so we can parameterize the space of solutions just by their value at t equals zero. If I want to solve this equation, you can say, if you give me p's at t equals zero, there's a unique solution to this equation because it's first ordering. Was that your question? So, really, what happens? If omega is not equal to d alpha. So, for example, M is the torus with coordinates theta 1, theta 2. These have some periodicity. And the symplectic form is d theta 1 wedge. So we actually, you know, there's some whole story about integration and Aram cohomology, which I think Giuseppe didn't get to finish. But I think for the purposes of this little piece, I'm just going to tell you what you need as we go. So you can tell that this can't be d of something. Well, because integral over s1 times s1 of omega is equal to 1. But the integral over s1 times s1 of d of alpha is 0. Because there's no boundary.
Wait, I'm sorry, Kevin. Would you mind saying again why the integral of omega is 1?
I'm just parameterizing the domain by the values of theta. It's really an integral. The integral theta 1 equals 0 to 1, 2 equals 0, 1, d theta 1, d theta 2.
Okay.
It's just an ordinary integral.
Okay. Well, if you have the wedge product, wouldn't you have that, but then also, like, minus the anti-symmetric part? Oh, but you have a 1/2 in front.
Oh, I mean, there's something which is a matter of conventions, but in some set of conventions, you just integrate this guy over here and this guy over here.
Wait, sorry, would you mind saying that again? What's the convention?
Oh, the convention is you just integrate the d theta 1 piece over the theta 1 variable and the d theta 2 piece over the theta 2 variable.
Why does that relate to like the anti-symmetry of the wedge product?
There's a slightly tricky thing that these have to be integrated over. Yeah, I'm integrating over square. Mm-hmm. The kind of thing I can integrate a two-form over is a square with an orientation. It means I have to choose clockwise or anti-clockwise. And that's kind of like, you know, choosing clockwise or anti-clockwise is the same thing as saying which one comes first, theta 1 or theta 2. And that ties into this issue of switching signs.
We have like half times that plus half times if the integral with them swapped, and then so it's the same thing?
Yes.
Okay.
I think I'm doing this out of order and it's confusing because the way you should think about it, I think it's just something Giuseppe explained. When you have an N form and an N dimensional manifold, and you go from one coordinate patch to another, you pick up a factor of the determinant of the Jacobian matrix.
Yeah.
When I do an integral, and I change coordinates, I also pick up a factor of the absolute value of the determinant of the Jacobian matrix. So there's an annoying thing about a sign, which is captured by this orientation, but this fact about coordinate changes of forms and integrals being the same is what tells you it's meaningful to do these, that these kinds of integrals make sense.
Why are we changing coordinates here? Isn't it all in theta 1 and theta 2? Where's the coordinate change?
I suppose that would be for a more general situation where you had to integrate over a patch. In a situation like this, I would say, I just define my integral. So if there was some function here, I define my integral, so it's just the ordinary naive integral you learned in calculus. And then you have to say, well, how do I know it's independent of the coordinates I've chosen?
Oh, okay.
And that's that thing about the Jacobian.
Okay.
I realize that 15 minutes left, maybe I can try to slot in this little thing about, maybe you won't get to the end of it. So what happens? Well, the issue is we can't write down our Lagrangian because our Lagrangian involved writing omega as d of something and then integrating over a path. So that doesn't make any sense. So instead, we have the following trick, which I think now is due to Carson Zimino. Let's take, for simplicity, I'm going to take time to be a circle. I want to do some kind of integral S1. This doesn't make any sense either, but I still don't know what alpha is. The trick is extend gamma from is a map from the circle to my manifold to gamma hat is a map from the disk to the manifold. Disk. Let's assume I can do this. And then integral over this disk. This makes sense. Because it's a two-form integrated over a two-manifold, so it's the right thing to integrate. However, it seems to be kind of bad because I wanted to start with the quantum mechanical system. Now I've suddenly said, oh, space-time is secretly a disk. How does that even ever make sense? You want this. The only way it's going to make sense is if this action does not depend on how I extend it. So this is the way of checking it, that it doesn't extend is what this Zimino trick. So if gamma hat 1, gamma hat 2 both extend gamma. This, then we can define a map eta now from the two sphere in my manifold. Where eta is gamma hat 1 above the equator, and gamma hat 2 below. And this makes sense because they agree on the disk in the, on the circle in the middle. So what we need action for gamma hat 1 minus the action for gamma hat 2 is equal to the integral over the 2 sphere of the pullback of omega. We need this to be 0. It a little bit, you realize that, you know, when you do quantum field theory, you don't really use the action, you use this exponential. R, we need e to the 2 pi, e to the I times integral over s 2, to be 1. This will be good enough too, because the action always appears in its exponentiated. Well, it turns out that this we can arrange. So this can happen. If cohomology. So did Giuseppe briefly mention cohomology? Or
no.
Yeah, okay.
I did not mention it.
Okay. So this is a topological constraint on omega. So for example, e.g., if omega is equal to some a d theta 1 d theta 2 on s1 times s1, we need a to be 2 pi times an integer. I know this is a little bit going beyond what we've done before, and it's kind of a pretty subtle thing. So the argument is that if I have a symplectic manifold where the integral of the form over any closed 2 cycle is 2 pi times an integer, then the system makes sense. And here we see we have a torus whose area is 2 pi times an integer, makes is a reasonable system, otherwise it's not. And maybe as we will see later, this is a reasonable constraint because in this system, the area of the torus is roughly the number of states up to a factor of 2 pi, you want the number of states to be an integer. It doesn't make sense at all. Okay, so as I said, I don't worry if this is a little beyond. I'll try to fit it in at the end. And I think next time we'll discuss gauge theory.